Hello and welcome to Satoshi's Mind, brought to you by Nakamoto. On Satoshi's Mind, we discuss recent trends in blockchain, DLT, and in the Web3 space, and some of the applications in other industries with experts working on those ideas. My name is Florian, and I got into blockchain at the end of 2013, beginning 2014, then did some stuff in the ICO space, then founded our current company, Nakamoto, and Advanced Blockchain together with some other people. And yeah, we're focusing on like building projects and investing in some projects as well. And here's my co-host, Connor.
Hey, Flo. Thank you. My name is Connor Kfiacin. I'm a comedian, audio person, and newcomer to the blockchain space. Suppressing the urge to say I'm new to the block because that's just tacky right there. But I'm here to be myself and help the conversation along. What's going on with you, Flo?
I'm currently in Germany, still here from since Christmas and New Year's, and yeah, going like traveling again soon to Dubai, where they just closed all bars. Yeah.
You can hear the sadness in your voice as you said that. But at least you'll be on the move again, getting out. Who do we have on the episode today?
So today our guest is Ilan Nahari. Ilan was a corporate and securities attorney focused on technology mergers and acquisitions. And yeah, when he became aware of crypto's potential in 2013, he established the first DLT practice at MITRE, which is Israel's leading technology law firm. Then he co-founded BXIL and Epifyte, which are two companies that focused on the Bitcoin payment space. And then he was also working with CementDAO. And prior to that, Ilan was lead enterprise commercial executive for blockchain and cloud technologies at Microsoft in New York. And now he works on ecosystem partnerships for Sovereign, which we're going to be talking about later as well. And you can find Sovereign on Twitter at SovereignBTC and head to their website at Sovereign, which is Sovryn.app. Welcome to the show, Ilan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys. Good to be here.
Likewise.
Yeah, to like jump into it, like what got you into blockchain and like what got you to like switch your focus to that industry?
Well, I think one thing that helped was being an attorney, because I think one thing that a lot of attorneys want to be is to be a former attorney. I'd actually heard about Bitcoin from my brother in 2011. He had just read the white paper and sent out an email to me and a bunch of my friends, basically saying this is going to be huge. You need to get your hands on some of this. And unfortunately, I promptly ignored that email, much to my regret. But Bitcoin was on my radar. I had known about it, but didn't really delve into it too deeply. And then about 2012, I had an interesting case where one of my clients came to me, and it was a bit of a tragic story. And basically what happened was that she had a son who had gotten into mining in 2010, had spoken to her a lot about Bitcoin, and she didn't understand what the hell he was rambling about. And unfortunately, he had passed away and had left her quite a significant amount of Bitcoin. That she didn't know what to do with. And I was kind of interested in the space. I would say more in like particularly more into the direction of the potential of smart contracts. And people around the firm knew that I was kind of connected. And so they directed her to me, and I started helping her to sell the Bitcoin that she received. And then about 2 months later, there was another client who came in and was running an exchange, and a Bitcoin exchange, and they were having a lot of difficulty getting banking partnerships, dealing with the tax authorities, doing all of their compliance. This was early 2013, and it was, you know, I think it's still a problem today, but then it was practically impossible as a business to go into a bank and open a business account and start operating your business. And I'd started noticing that this was a recurring problem for a number of exchanges. This was in Israel at the time, and saw an opportunity there to basically set up a company and help these exchanges with all of their operations, their back-end compliance, getting them banking partners. And so I co-founded a company in early 2013 that was supposed to do that. And I started getting a lot deeper into Bitcoin, started, you know, my journey of understanding what the potential here is. And then in late 2013 and early 2014, the Mt. Gox hack happened. And about 70% of our clients, exchange clients, had gone under because they were holding their accounts with Mt. Gox. And so that was my first, I would say, experience with the fragility of centralized operators providing services around Bitcoin. From there, I co-founded another company called Epiphyte. And, you know, at the time, it seemed like a good idea to look at the potential that Bitcoin has to act as a kind of SWIFT alternative or a payments rails for international payments for banks, because it's just, you know, much more secure, much faster, all the things that we're familiar today that Bitcoin brings, we believe could be quite a interesting proposition for banks. And so we co-founded Epiphyte, which was developing technologies to allow banks to settle between themselves on Bitcoin rails. And we onboarded a number of global banks, and kind of, you know, Bitcoin was a new semi-exciting thing for them. And they were willing to enter into a proof of concept and try it out, especially the banks with the more adventurous CTOs. But then at that point, that was it. After doing a POC, that's where the party ended, and they just wouldn't, you know, explore this any further in terms of integrating it into their systems. And so we pivoted that company into doing remittances, primarily between Europe and Africa, Europe and Latin America, based on the same technology rails that we built out for the banks. And that proved to be quite a successful business because basically we could offer remittance payments with no fees, and we'd make our profit on the arbitrage of the price of Bitcoin between Europe and Africa, or Europe and Latin America. And so we started gaining traction. We even became regulated with the FCA in the UK and helped them build out the crypto sandbox back in 2014. And the company started gaining traction. And then we were reminded in 2017 that there's still a very big issue with operating a centralized business in the Bitcoin space. And what essentially happened is we had a corresponding bank in the US, JP Morgan, who back at the time was very anti-Bitcoin, basically telling all of the banks that they worked with that they're not going to provide USD-based banking services for any company involved in the crypto space. And we couldn't operate the company and provide the level of service for our customers that we wanted to if we had to change our banking partner every few months. And so I had also worked at Microsoft and seen how Microsoft kind of transitioned from this stage of developing private blockchains to the point where they realized that that's pretty pointless, and that there's a lot more opportunity in building on top of public blockchains like Bitcoin or Ethereum. And all of this, you know, really drove home the realization that, you know, everyone's excited about Bitcoin and the promise that it brings. And that's rooted in the fact that it is decentralized, because then it can offer the advantages of being permissionless and uncensorable. And the idea of building a business on top of Bitcoin that is centralized and is censorable by either regulators, or is a honeypot for hackers, or can easily be shut down if the banks don't like what you're doing, just seemed nonsensical. And at that point, kind of early 2018, I transitioned 100% to working in the decentralized space with the understanding that, you know, Bitcoin brings a certain promise of uncensorable money. But on top of that, there's still plenty to build in the realm of uncensorable finance.
It seems like you have a history of bridging. Well, I guess it's less so now, but you're bridging kind of the older technology with the newer technology of crypto and everything that's going on in the space. How did you feel prepared coming from as an attorney? And like, what was that feeling like trying to bridge these two things together?
So it's an interesting question. You know, one of the things that really interests me about the space was the concept of smart contracts and automating human collaboration. Because law is essentially code. It's human code designed to facilitate behaviors and balance incentives between people and companies. And when I first learned about smart contracts and the ability of automating this, which means a few things. It means that the rules are known. It means that the playing field is leveled between people who have, generally in the traditional world, a lot more leverage, and there's asymmetry in information. It brings transparency, and also the aspect that, you know, I had figured like, wow, if this catches on, there are going to be a bunch of attorneys without a job. So I better start thinking how I get involved in this. But, you know, my personal journey took a very long time in terms of, I think, fully appreciating what's going on. And what Bitcoin means. And, you know, there are plenty of distractions along the way. There's, you know, what is the promise of Bitcoin? What are people going to use it for? You know, and the space went through this as well. Is it digital gold? Is it payments? Is there promise or are there applications for blockchain beyond a monetary network? This is just a very new phenomena that takes, I think, a long time to wrap your head around. And part of my process was, or part of the process that I went through, was trying to really understand it in the terms that I was familiar with. And that's, you know, the traditional world, traditional finance, traditional legal systems and structures. And it took me a while to basically understand that 90% of that is no longer relevant. There is a technology that we have here that basically removes so much of, you know, what I would call kind of the transaction costs that we have when we engage with other people and when we engage commercially. And this is a technology that just changes the rules of the game. And so I think at first I was trying to bridge that gap and see how we can apply it to traditional finance, to even to the legal world. And I think it took me a while to realize that, you know, there's an opportunity to revamp things totally, to do things in a totally different way. And that's definitely, you know, for me was a very long process that I'm still undergoing and I'm still learning. But I think now I appreciate that there's an opportunity and the technology is mature enough today to replicate services that people need in a trustless, permissionless way that is fully accessible, open, and transparent. And I think that's an incredible change.
Yeah, it's definitely getting pretty interesting with the recent developments. Since you were also working at Microsoft, like, what was it like there? Could you also like really live out this innovation, or was it more like kind of really in a box? And like, I think Microsoft was working on like the whole Azure thing there, right? Like, how was your experience there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I was in Microsoft at an interesting time for them, because they were trying to find any way possible to add value on top of Azure, because they were competing with AWS, which was very much an uphill battle. And, you know, to Microsoft's credit, I think that they adopted a relatively nuanced approach to blockchain and ways in which they can participate in that industry. You know, when you look at the big tech companies, Amazon, for instance, is not really doing anything in the space. At least at the time when I was at Microsoft, and I think adopted more of a wait and see approach. And if something pans out, you know, let's just buy the startups that are successful. Google wasn't really participating, which I think was because, you know, Google gets 90% of its profits from advertising. And so it doesn't really have the internal incentive to kind of shake things up. IBM was fully focused on private blockchain bullshit. Microsoft started looking into, you know, private blockchain consortiums. One project I was working on was a consortium between North American energy providers and giving them a way to basically trade energy surplus. And, you know, after working on these things for a few months, you always come to the same conclusion. A blockchain isn't needed here. There are other technologies that you can use. That can validate supply chains, that can secure information between participants. But essentially, if it's a private consortium, you're always going to need some sort of contractual agreement between the parties or some sort of understanding, because there is no mechanism that provides, you know, the immutability of the data. Unless there are parties who are incentivized to provide the security and compute power to secure that data. And, you know, I was at Microsoft at a time when I think they realized this and they made the decision that they're going to start developing on Ethereum. They'll start developing on Bitcoin, leveraging those public blockchains to provide solutions that, you know, we're quite innovative at the time. For instance, one of the things was building an identity system based on the blockchain. Things that I think there is potentially a use case for. And the only way you can really get there is by having a blockchain that is fully open and trustless. And so they started working on public blockchains. But I, you know, one of the reasons I left was that the real cutting edge innovation, the real interesting, in my mind also, world-changing technologies were not being developed in these tech companies. They were being developed in the strange cryptoverse with, you know, as much as there's a lot of noise in the crypto sphere and a lot of projects that, you know, aren't really doing interesting stuff, there's 10% that is cutting edge and is building the financial and economical layers of the future, without a doubt.
Is that 10% where you see sovereign being?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think there are a few primitives that, or a few fundamentals that I think are important. One is to recognize that the real DeFi, the first DeFi, you know, what we call decentralized finance, is Bitcoin. It is a decentralized monetary asset. The only thing that really has a shot at being a global reserve currency. There are a lot of things that have grown around that ecosystem of Bitcoin. Some of them are straight up competing with Bitcoin for its monetary premium. And a lot of them are building out solutions that don't, you know, solutions for problems that I don't think really exist, you know, like supply chain and healthcare. I think we're very early in this process of understanding what blockchain can bring. And the only real thing that it has proven is that it can maintain a proof of work. Blockchain can maintain a decentralized monetary network. And so, with sovereign, the thinking is, you know, you have to leverage Bitcoin. That's the gravity well of this whole space. That is, you know, the only monetary asset that any institution, any serious investor is going to look at, and that's where the monetary premium has accrued. But on the other hand, you know, when you look at Ethereum, there's a lot of noise and a lot of junk there. But it has proven to be the most exceptional proving ground and venue for extremely cutting edge innovation. And this is recent. This is, I think, only over the last, you know, max 2 years, 18 months, when, you know, it started out with Maker and then things like Compound, and now Uniswap. And it's just proving that there's still so much to explore in the space, because in the end of the day, not that I don't have an opinion, but I don't spend too much time thinking about blockchain or crypto applications that are non-financial. Maybe there will be in the future, I don't know. But right now, the main application is financial. And where Bitcoin has proven that it is the monetary base, Ethereum and a lot of protocols that are building on Ethereum today are proving out that there is a financial case for decentralization and for providing value, proving product market fit, and actually creating protocols that drive revenue. So with Sovereign, what we're attempting to do and what we think is important is to marry these two. It's to bring the innovation from Ethereum, bring the monetary base from Bitcoin, merge them, so that now, you know, you not only have your Sovereign money if you hold Bitcoin, you know, if you self-custody Bitcoin, you have your Sovereign money, but now you also have your Sovereign financial protocol. You have the ability to self-custody your funds and still leverage them without anyone being able to say, you can't perform this transaction, you can't send your funds to here, or you can't participate because you're in a jurisdiction that we don't allow. You know, and I think the last few weeks have shown how important this is becoming. You know, the whole issue with censoring people who wanted to trade GameStop or AMC. That's the world we live in. And I think a lot of people in the West don't fully appreciate it because they haven't come against it. But increasingly, they're going to come against more censorship, more reductions of their financial liberty. You know, and I grew up in South Africa, and my family wanted to leave the country in the early 90s and just simply couldn't because of capital controls. They were, you know, they weren't allowed to take money out of the country. But financial sovereignty is, in my mind, a huge aspect of general freedom and general sovereignty.
Yeah, especially like recently, I think it's getting a lot more interesting with all the censorship stuff going on lately.
Yeah, I mean, if you live in Argentina or Turkey or many other countries, this isn't new to you at all. But now I think there are a lot of people who haven't experienced this in their lifetime, haven't experienced a situation where, you know, people think, okay, my money's in the bank, I can do with it what I want. You certainly can't do with it what you want if you want to trade in crypto, you know, and that was kind of a lot of my story was companies and people who lost that liberty. But now, you know, you can't trade regular stocks, and this is just the beginning. I think,
yeah,
I think regulators and nation states are going to leverage this tool, this monopoly that they have over the financial system, more and more as the world becomes more and more unstable.
Yeah, I feel like in the future, I feel like there will definitely be a lot of blockchain stuff moving into the financial world wherever possible, like through like really DeFi, like decentralized finance, but even like applications which are built on blockchain kind of. Yeah, interesting time. I was also wondering, so I think it's definitely really cool to build on Bitcoin. I guess it's not been done that much before, since like everybody's just building on Ethereum due to, I guess, like a lot of the volume already being there. And I guess on the other hand, because everybody really knows how to work with Solidity. So I think you're using rootstock, right? I was just like wondering, what's your experience with that? Like, is it like easy to develop? Since when does it like work properly so that you can do that? And like, how's smart contracting on Bitcoin going?
So about 2 years ago, I was working on a protocol that was a liquidity aggregator for stablecoins called Cemento. And at that point, it was clear to me that we have to launch on Ethereum. That is where the users are, the developers are, the liquidity is. And so that was a no-brainer. But over the last 12 months, I think a few things have happened. One, we've seen a lot of protocols prove themselves out on Ethereum and basically create kind of a Solidity network effect, right? The network effect isn't necessarily going to accrue to Ethereum, but it might accrue to Solidity because now you can build bridges between different chains. But still, you know, if you're developing in a language that isn't Solidity, good luck finding someone with experience. Specifically with regards to rootstock, you know, rootstock is EVM compatible and has been around for a while. But I think a rootstock hasn't gained traction for two reasons. One is that it's very Bitcoin focused. You know, it's a chain that hasn't got its own native asset. And so the team behind rootstock has been very, very focused on building an extremely secure chain. And that took a lot of time. Another thing is that I don't think Bitcoiners or you know, the ICO craze of 2017, 2018 happened on Ethereum. I don't think something similar would have happened on rootstock. And, you know, maybe it's just a matter of timing. Maybe Ethereum came out before rootstock and it happened there. But over the last 12 months, rootstock has, in my mind, become kind of production ready. And another shift in the space is that I think, especially now with the congestion on Ethereum and the fact that everyone this year is going to have to move to a layer two, there's going to be a certain amount of fragmentation. There's going to be a certain amount of spillover onto other chains like Polkadot and Cosmos. And there's going to be more and more bridges, trustless bridges between these different chains. And so in my mind, the network effect's going to start accruing to assets rather than to chains. And the most important asset is Bitcoin. And the second most important asset or asset class is stablecoins. And by the end of 2021, those are going to move around pretty freely between many different chains that offer different security assurances, you know, offer different optimization for different use case, whether it's, you know, gambling or trading or NFTs or gaming. And so it's kind of a convergence of timing where I think there is an opportunity to take the advances that have been made in Ethereum, deploy them on or inside the Bitcoin ecosystem, and create a vertically integrated product that provides your base financial primitives, you know, lending, borrowing, trading, spot trading, margin trading, which, you know, I isn't really something that exists on Ethereum today. You know, there isn't one venue where you can go and do everything. And it's not really a problem now because you have this composability between all of these protocols. But I don't know how that's going to play out when you have Uniswap moving to one type of layer two and Compound moving potentially onto their own chain. I think there's going to be a level of disruption here, and there's an opportunity both for a vertically integrated DeFi product that uses Bitcoin natively and is able to connect to any other chain in order to allow users to bring in any asset that they want to trade with. And I think that's the opportunity that we're trying to take advantage of with Sovereign.
Yeah, definitely pretty interesting. Yeah, a friend of mine he just got into like the whole like trading round thing. And I was telling him like, yeah, like trading Ripple and Bitcoin and all that stuff on like a 50x margin. That's like super fun and you can do that. But you could also check out this decentralized finance stuff. And he was like, oh, cool. How do I do that? And then we looked at it and then we came to the conclusion, well, you actually can't because it costs like $100 to like make a trade on Uniswap. So there's totally no point for you to even like try this out. And yeah. Like kind of sucks. Like no one that's not like rich basically can now start doing decentralized finance, which was designed to like give this like power to do all that stuff back to normal people. So yeah. I feel like there's definitely
the promise of Ethereum was that it's going to be the most inclusive decentralized finance, anyone can participate. But in reality it's basically become the most exclusive network right now. A playground for whales. And I think this is definitely a temporary situation, and I don't think Ethereum is going anywhere. And I think, you know, with ETH 2.0 and optimistic rollups and ZK rollups, I think there will be a resolution to that issue. The question is what happens between then and now?
Yeah.
And I think you also mentioned another interesting point where, you know, crypto adoption kind of comes in waves, more or less aligned to the bull markets that happen every 4 years or so. And so at least the user base of Sovereign, I think the majority of the users are people who came into crypto 2017 and earlier and have built a level of comfort and a level of appreciation where they don't see it simply as, you know, I'm going to go 50x on XRP now and see what happens. But an understanding around the fact that you can, in a way, opt out of the traditional financial system because, you know, now more and more there are financial products that are available to you, right? If you hold Bitcoin from a few years ago, you can now collateralize it and get a loan in dollars and use that to pay your bills. Or you can earn passive yield on your Bitcoin, you know, rather than just sitting there, you can earn 5-6% a year. And I think with the time comes also the appreciation of what self-custody means. You know, people who get into the space, I think are excited about the promise and number go up. But in the end, they keep their Bitcoin on Coinbase, on Binance. And it takes time. It takes time to understand what self-custody means because, you know, honestly, self-custody is scary. It's a lot of responsibility. There are plenty of Bitcoiners I speak to, even Bitcoiners have been around the space for a while and say, you know what, I keep my funds on an exchange because, you know, I know it's not safe potentially and tomorrow a regulator can come and freeze funds or a hacker can come. But I have that feeling that if something happens, there's someone I can blame. And I think there's a psychological shift that you have to go through. Because when you self-custody your funds, there is no one to blame but yourself. But the fact is you do see that evolution. I think people in DeFi now have been in the space for a few years and are starting to appreciate it. And people who come into the space in this bull market that I think is going to happen over the next year, they'll be in DeFi in 3 to 4 years, without a doubt. A lot of people in their 20s today or teens, I don't think they're, you know, if you're 15 years old today, you might never need a bank account. You can have a credit card that's tied to stable coins and your crypto account. So there's a lot of shift happening, and I think, you know, also on the market as a whole, but also on an individual level, self-custody is scary. It's a mind shift. We've been trained for years that, put your money in a bank. The government's going to insure it. You don't need to worry. You don't need to take responsibility. But that's an abnormality. That's not how things should be. People should take responsibility for their finances. I think it builds an appreciation for it and builds a sense of responsibility. And then perhaps you'll see less people going 50x on XRP. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I also have a feeling that people definitely get more ideological the longer they're like active in the space.
Yeah, for sure.
I know you all seem to raise money pretty quick over there at Sovereign. That must have been exciting. What does that kind of mean for the future? And where do you all see Sovereign going as it grows?
So one of the most exciting things that happened. So Sovereign's been, we've been working on Sovereign, a group of contributors from kind of ideation to execution for about 12 months. So we've been thinking about these things for a long time. And, there's this saying, I worked many years to achieve overnight success. So there has been an extensive period of building it out and figuring out how to build it and where to build it, because the Bitcoin ecosystem, people haven't really done this before. People haven't been exploring it before. And Sovereign did manage to raise money from private investors who I think, and those conversations were interesting as well, right? Because you have to explain to people why rootstock. No one's building on rootstock. And you get a fair amount of objections and even dismissal at first. But once you kind of dive into the opportunity here, and the opportunity is pretty simple to lay out. Only 8% of Bitcoin today is being leveraged for financial activity, whether it's passive yield, loans, borrowing. Less than 10%, I think. On that, maybe 7-8% is in centralized companies like BlockFi, Celsius, Nexo, and maybe 1% is wrapped on Ethereum. And the majority of that is with the central issuer, BitGo. And if you look at the graph of wrapped Bitcoin on Ethereum last year, it's the graph that grew faster than any other part of the crypto ecosystem. So that really demonstrates that there is a lot of latent demand. There are a lot of people that are sitting on Bitcoin and want to leverage it. I mean, it's the most natural thing in the world to want to put your money to work. But these are people who hold Bitcoin. These are people who appreciate the ideas of self-custody and permissionless finance. And we've seen this also over the last year. Unprecedented amounts of Bitcoin are leaving exchanges and going into self-custody. And so when you take these trends together, you start realizing that there's a huge opportunity here. Every person who trades on Ethereum, every single one, holds Bitcoin as well. I don't think there's anyone in the space, or maybe a few, that doesn't hold Bitcoin. They might like Ethereum more than Bitcoin. They might like other projects more. But everyone's holding Bitcoin, and everyone wants to put their money to work. And not everyone, I'd say even the majority, don't want to submit their Bitcoin that they worked hard for, and put it back into the traditional financial system and then be at the mercy of hackers or regulators.
Yeah.
So I think when you start looking at it like that, it makes more sense. There are other things that are happening. A lot of the users of Sovereign actually came from BitMEX. BitMEX introduced KYC and lost about 50 or 60% of their deposits because, there's a very high level of uncertainty. I try to take out a loan with Nexo or with Celsius. One day they tell you your loan is being approved. The next day they tell you, oh, our license for operating in the UK has been revoked. We can't give you a loan. Or in Nexo, everything's fine. You deposit your funds. You want to take your Bitcoin out? Wait, you have to go through further verification. And those are extreme violations of privacy, and also introduce extreme levels of uncertainty, because sometimes they ask for documentation that you can't provide. If you mined Bitcoin in 2011, how are you going to explain where you got your Bitcoin from?
Yeah.
And so a lot of the users are from BitMEX who want to trade, but want an assurance that no one's going to censor their trades. No one's going to block them from using the money in the way they want to. So what happened with Sovereign a couple of weeks ago, actually, is the first version of the governance was launched. And one of the first things that happened was that the governance gave everyone who opened a wallet and performed a trade on the system before January 8th, and the system only launched in December 15th. Everyone who used the system up until January 8th will give the option to pre-order the governance token. And this was only announced on January 8th, meaning you couldn't come and just create a wallet in order to get into the sale. It's what we call the Genesis event, because really the idea is to give the early users who took the risk and, you know, opened a wallet on RSK, and interacted with a system that is still very young and committed their funds to it, we wanted to bring them into the community and have them be a part of the community. And so that sale was closed in 20 minutes, and 800 of the users participated, with about 2,000 who couldn't get in. And so I think these things are demonstrating that, one, there's a lot of potential for the Bitcoin space, and two, you know, a lot of these people are performing trades. You know, they could range from $50 to $10,000. You can't do that on Ethereum. You can't use DeFi on Ethereum today in the sense that, you know, unless you're making more than $100, $150 a trade, you're losing money. And people want these services. And so I think there's a huge amount of opportunity, and I think the community and I think investors as well are sensing this, and that's kind of the wave that Sovereign's riding right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah. I know we're getting close to that 45-minute mark. It's been a fascinating conversation. Before we close out, Flo, do you have anything else you wanna ask?
No, nothing on my mind spontaneously.
All right. Well, Elon, thank you very much for joining us on Satoshi's Mind.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, guys, for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
If you want to check out Sovereign some more, you can find them on Twitter at SovereignBTC, or head to their website, sovereign.app. That's Sovereign spelled Sovryn. And if you want to follow this show, you can head to Twitter and follow @S_Nakamoto_TO. No, that's Nakamoto. If you want to follow this show, it's @Satoshi_Mind. That's why I was mixing it up, Flo. I knew I had it somewhere up there. Make sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening. Please subscribe. And Elon, thank you so much again.
Thanks a lot, guys. Stay sovereign. Yeah.
Yeah.